This programming is sponsored by the UH Health Family Care Center, offering primary care and behavioral health services on the University of Houston campus. Health insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid, accepted. New patient appointments and more at 832-UH-CARES.
This programming is sponsored by Linscomb Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at LinscombWealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk a little politics, both national and local. Lots going on, Brandon. Let's go up with the big international issue that's popped up, and that's the Iran nuke deal. It seems like it's never going away. It's back in the news. We even got the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, weighing in. What's going on there?
Yeah, so the Prime Minister, as you said, of Israel has claimed that his country has evidence that Iran has lied about its nuclear programming and, in effect, plans to continue to develop nuclear weapons despite this agreement, which is in place since 2015, to require them to stop. There's some, I think, pushback on this. The EU has said that Netanyahu hasn't filed any formal complaints about it. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said there's no evidence of this, but Secretary of State Pompeo has said that the evidence is real and the U.S. is weighing it. The deadline here, Jay, is the 12th of May, and that is the deadline by which the U.S. has to choose whether or not they're going to waive sanctions that were lifted under the deal. To me, the president tends to be persuaded by evidence which is more recent and dramatic. And if you saw Netanyahu's kind of unveiling of this, it was this giant PowerPoint presentation, him standing in front of this big screen that said, you know, Iran lied. So this is pretty persuasive. And I suspect that it probably suggests that the Iran deal is dead from the U.S. perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I think most of the analysts who have tracked this have essentially stated that none of the information is in fact new. Most of it deals with events that took place prior to the deal itself, sort of makes the argument for the deal. I don't know. You can never tell with President Trump because of what you said. He tends to be persuaded by the last person who's sort of making the argument to him, and especially in a dramatic way. So we'll see what ultimately happens. But I'm going to say that the Iran deal is still going to go in force, and they may be looking at expanding and doing something else.
Yeah. Well, the president said, like, I was right. So we'll see if that means that he decides to undo this or not, like he's promised. One area where maybe he wasn't so right is about the investigation and the content of the investigation. So we've got a bunch of blockbuster questions this week that were leaked from the Mueller camp. What's going on?
Yeah, so about 48 areas or questions were sort of leaked out that were given to the Trump legal team by Robert Mueller, the special counsel. And so as a consequence, it's out there. There's been a lot of conversation about it. It essentially kind of seems to point to confirmation about the line of questions that were being asked. It's still, I think, up in the air whether they were meant as a preview of what would be in a sort of a subpoena or some sort of deposition style would be interviewing. Mm-hmm. Or if it was for written response, which I tend to think it was.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, the questions to me suggest that the campaign activity part of the investigation is more pointed than the firing of James Comey. That suggests that perhaps Mueller is more interested in the collusion part of this. The questions were directed at intent, which is really, I think, interesting to me. They want to know what the mindset was for the president. And so I think that's possibly where he's going. The question here, of course, all swirls around this controversy about the Trump and his legal team, right? So this is a big part of where the president's going to go and what kind of defense they can mount. This week, it was reported that Ty Cobb, who is he of great mustache fame, I wish we could on the podcast show you visually what he looks like. If you haven't seen him, take a look at a picture. It is hilarious. He's got this great kind of handlebar mustache. He is reportedly retiring, which means that he basically will be off the team and they're bringing in new attorneys, which is part of this shuffling of chairs on the Trump legal team. Jay, what does this mean and why should we care?
Yeah, Ty Cobb's out and Emmett Flood is in. Emmett Flood famously was...
Great names. Just
I know.
Right.
The names are great, aren't they? I mean, Emmett Flood was the impeachment lawyer for Bill Clinton back in the late 90s.
It's a good get for Trump, right?
Yeah. And so I think the big issue there is just sort of, you know, are you going from a peacetime to a wartime consigliere
right.
type deal? Or is it just that the fact that the universe or the bar associated with people involved in these kinds of cases is relatively small, so it's not that uncommon. But along with that, and this sort of change in legal team and legal strategy, you've got just a recently hired Rudy Giuliani,
right,
who's also part of this team, essentially going on Sean Hannity's program and admitting that the president of the United States was aware and did pay Michael Cohen $130,000 that he knew was going to be paid to pay off Stormy Daniels.
I can't figure out why he would admit this, right? I mean, the whole defense from the president was that he didn't know anything about this. And now it turns out he does, and his lawyer is admitting it. To me, it's like, you know, getting a first round draft pick, right? High profile superstar, the first play of the first game, they fumble it, right? And then run it the wrong way, right, to the end zone. So I think this is just another unforced error from the Trump legal team.
Well, I don't know about that, because here's my theory. I think that in looking at all of the documentation that Michael Cohen had and having conversations with Michael Cohen, they have a fairly strong sense that President Trump paid him back the $130,000, and there may have been receipts. Cohen himself may have acknowledged that. And I think this was Rudy Giuliani's attempt to get out in front. You put it out there and you sort of litigate this in the public. And I think it's been pointed out in the past that when we've seen these sort of revelations happen, you don't get the reaction. People don't seem to care. You get it out there and sort of take away some of it. There may be a little more method than madness here with Rudy Giuliani.
It's actually interesting. Some of the things I find in my book on scandal is that presidents are more likely to come clean when there's a verifiable paper trail like that can be proven. And so this makes complete sense that they'd want to kind of come clean because they know at some point they're going to get caught. Speaking of paper trail, we've got some interesting developments about this letter from 2015 that said that Trump was the healthiest individual ever elected to the president from the president's at the time doctor, Dr. Harold Borstein. But apparently he didn't write the letter. Who did?
Yes, yes. And guess what? The person who wrote the letter is in fact the president of the United States. That was dictated by Donald Trump. And as we talked about earlier in one of the previous podcasts, Dr. Borstein's office was then subsequently raided by the Trump campaign or Trump officials to try to get out all his paperwork related to President Trump. So, when he made that statement, I think the general consensus was it's probably not true.
Right.
Well, we now know for certain that it's not true.
Right. Or it may have been true, but it was certainly crafted in such a way that benefited the president. The president at the time, the candidate Trump, attacked Hillary Clinton mercilessly, right, for her health and stamina, right? Remember, she was kind of wobbly and sick after leaving a particular memorial event in New York. So this is, I think, as hypocritical as it gets. I don't know if we could even write this as fiction to make it look real, Jay. This is so bizarre.
Well, speaking of bizarre, Brandon, I know you probably know we have five branches of the military: Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, and Coast Guard. Well, the president has talked about this before, but he wants to add a sixth.
That's right. I don't know. Are we going to get lightsabers to battle with? Can we get blasters?
Exactly. The Space Force. The President of the United States wants to create a Space Force because to quote him, we're really big in space now.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We're bigly in space, right? Well, hey, let's talk Texas. There's some interesting developments this week on the legal front. We talked last week about the legal case on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. This week, Ken Paxton, our attorney general, has injected Texas into this and has sued the administration for essentially abusing power, in particular to ignoring the will of the people and allowing for DACA to continue when it was an overreach of executive authority, according to the attorney general. What do you make of this?
Yeah, Texas joined a total of six states that have been involved in this litigation. It's not unlike a similar case that was filed when you had DAPA, which was the parents, involving the parents of childhood arrivals. So I think the big issue here is a lot of this stuff has been settled in the federal system already. You've had two or three separate district court judges that have ruled that DACA should continue. This is just politics by Ken Paxton trying to force the issue. I'm not sure it's really that serious at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's a trope that works, though, right? Republican primary voters and Republican voters in general are stimulated by these kinds of attacks. So this is definitely something that is going to keep the Republicans, I think, slightly ahead of the game here.
Well, one other thing that we know that gets Republican voters going is relates to the NRA and guns. And Dallas is hosting the annual NRA convention. Not only the vice president, but the president of the United States are coming down to tour it.
Yeah, also Greg Abbott, John Cornyn, Ted Cruz are going to be there. I think for the president, this is an unusual approach. I mean, he had floated ideas that were not well embraced by the NRA, right? Especially something like universal background check and increasing the age to be able to purchase a rifle. But I think for the president, this is, like many he's done in the past, an act of contrition. He has to go here to make amends for the kinds of statements that he's floated, maybe informally, but that have been treated as a kind of political backtracking. So this is an interesting dynamic. Another interesting dynamic is that no guns will be allowed at the NRA convention. To me, this is like banning lapel carnations at the Society of American Florists convention.
Exactly, right? I mean, you know, I think politically, this might be the best the Democrats could hope for.
Yeah.
You know, the NRA has been increasingly sort of villainized through this process, and it just sort of, they get tied to Trump that much more. It probably works in their favor. You know, the polling indicates that general election voters, independent voters, are leaning or certainly favorable to the position that Democrats have espoused on gun control. So I think this is a win for Dems.
Yeah.
Speaking of a win for Dems, we've got calls for debates, and looks like we're going to have some of them. What's going on? Beto's calling out Ted Cruz, and then we're going to actually have a gubernatorial debate on the Democratic side, Brandon?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I think this is a smart play for O'Rourke. I mean, he said that he wants to have six debates, and he wants to have two in Spanish. To me, this does two things that are good for him. It pushes the debate issue so that they begin to strike first on that. O'Rourke needs more debates. He needs more interactions with Cruz, and he needs to be more exposed to the people. So that's one way to do it. And the other is that this, even if the Spanish debates don't happen, potentially cuts into Cruz's support among Hispanics. If Cruz ends up getting 30% of the Latino vote, then O'Rourke cannot win. So this is a potentially way for O'Rourke, even if he doesn't get the debate, to be able to say that he's putting a marker down that this is important to him.
I mean, Ted Cruz is a master debater, nationally recognized. He was a college champ. I don't think there's any doubt that you'll see a lot of them. The one thing Cruz is known for is that he has great confidence in his oratorical skills. This, again, the normal dynamic would be for him to sort of have as few as possible. But Ted Cruz, I think, takes a lot of pride in his ability to persuade the public. And so I wouldn't be surprised if you have many of them now on Spanish.
You think he wants
probably
to?
Probably not. Yeah, I think Cruz
not
will
Spanish.
Debate him.
Yeah.
Certainly not in Spanish, but I think Cruz will take the debates, mainly because I think suggesting that Cruz doesn't want to do a lot of debates, in some ways, I think, cuts to his manhood, so to speak.
Okay.
So I think he'll debate. On the Democratic side, we finally got a debate between Andrew White and Lupe Valdez. What happened there?
Yeah, so this has been a kind of a dance between the two. White has been asking for debates, and Valdez has been reluctant, in part, I think, because obviously as the front runner, she doesn't want necessarily to be seen as being on the same stage as he, right? She wants to ride out what was likely going to be a victory for her if there's no continued friction. And I think also there's a risk that she could flub, that she could crumble the way that she has in these other interactions like she did this last week. So this is, I think, a potential problem for her and really a win for White.
Yeah, she lost another endorsement by a young Latino group that's supposed to be the demographic she's reaching. They endorsed Andrew White in large part because of her lack of base knowledge on some key issues. It's a real issue for her, and we'll kind of see what happens kind of going forward.
Yeah, I think she missed the dunk on this. I mean, there was a chance for her to be able to really connect with where the electorate's going to be, right? The young Latino voters are going to be a significant force in the next 15 years, and she wasn't able to convert, so this is a big problem for her.
Well, let's take a quick break. We come back, let's talk about the big court case change that took place and the impact on the elections. The Texas voter ID law is back.
So, Jay, the big news of the week was that we have yet another federal appeals court weigh in on Texas's voter ID law. In this case, we have a 2-1 ruling that said that essentially that the revised requirements for voter ID in Texas are legitimate, and those who had tried to approve discriminatory effect haven't done so. So we are here in another limbo because we know that the people who oppose voter ID can ask the full Fifth Circuit to reconsider the case or possibly look to the Supreme Court for relief. Texas is happy because they've essentially won this round, at least maybe permanently. What do you think?
Yeah, I think they probably have won it permanently. I mean, so the genesis of this was that there's been a lot of back and forth on the legality of the need to show a specific kind of voter ID at the polls. We know that in-person voter fraud is essentially non-existent. People just don't pretend they're someone else and go vote. They either vote in the wrong location, or they vote incorrectly, but they rarely are trying to impersonate someone. That said, there had been many manifestations and changes on the voter ID law. The last go-around that they just upheld was actually another court imposed one that was and legislatively changed as a result of a court ruling. So I think you're going to probably go to a full panel by the Fifth Circuit. You'll probably see them uphold what the three-judge panel did. It may eventually go up to the Supreme Court, but I think what you'll probably see, assuming the Supreme Court takes it, that we're going to continue to have voter ID, because I think there's some underlying basis for it. Democrats are going to have to adjust to this, the new reality of what it is, and try to figure out ways, maybe add more means and more protections in place. But I think this is going to be the law of the land, and it's moving forward. They're going to have to deal with it.
And more information, too. I think one of the biggest factors that we tend to forget is that the implementation of this is really key. Now, I think that, like you say, the Democrats are going to have to live with this, but the implementation on the ground is really going to be the important thing. People have to know exactly what their rights are, and the Democrats are going to have to, you know, coach the individuals who are going to go vote, essentially. That creates another layer. I don't know if it's so much about it actively discriminating against people, right? This is a legal question, which we can put aside for the second. But I definitely see that it's another impediment to voting. And we know that the more of these kinds of costs, the more of these kinds of interactions we build in, the more difficult it is to get people to vote and to come out. So I think that's probably a solvable problem, but it is definitely a problem for the Democrats. The results are mixed. I mean, the scholarship on voter IDs has been inconsistent. The effects about what voter ID does have been mixed. The kind of consensus is that in primary elections, there's an increased gap between white and Asian turnouts. And in general elections, there's an increased gap between white and Hispanic turnouts. So there's definitely going to be some divide there. That doesn't benefit the Democrats, who typically are looking to Latinos, and may, though, benefit Republicans, who typically look to whites.
Yeah, we know that in the case of minority voters, particularly older voters, and lower income voters, they tend to not have as many of the IDs or reference ID forms that this bill contains. And so we know that there's a disproportionate impact on them. So it definitely favors, I think, from a partisan perspective, one side versus the other. The real question is, how do you adjust to it? Texas already has some of the lowest participation rates in the country. Voter access is an issue here in Texas. So how the Democrats react, particularly as you see more voting changes occurring. We're losing the straight ticket ballot, for example, in 2020. This is the last election cycle where you'll have that. Texas has a very long ballot itself. I don't know, Brandon, do you see maybe more people pushing for mail ballots?
Yeah.
Do we see more people trying to go early? What happens to sort of the dynamics and mechanics of voting?
Yeah, voter ID definitely only affects people who vote in person. So that is most of people's voting habits. But campaigns have pushed lately to put more into the mail ballot program, which gives you greater certainty someone's voted, so campaigns like it. It's a little bit more expensive to deal with, and also the legislature has clamped down on some of those issues too. So there's been some issues with respect to vote harvesting that have been problematic and that the state has sought to really limit. So that also, I think, is pretty much the next battle in terms of how voting comes about. But like you say, I mean, if you look at the states that are potentially battleground states like North Carolina, Wisconsin, in the future maybe Texas, and even Pennsylvania, surveys suggest that white respondents do not have driver's license or passports at a rate of about 7%. That's 17% for black respondents and 9% for Latinos. So there's a tremendous racial gap. That impacted times, you know, the number of people voting has potential to limit the Democrats' growth. Even if it's not discriminatory racially, it definitely has a different demographics, which I think is going to change the voting electorate.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that this is part of a long line of sort of impediments that are put in place to make it more difficult for people to vote. We talk about this all the time. It's one of the rare things that you see is that the right to vote is sort of enshrined in the Constitution, but we've had a historical structure that has essentially tried to govern that process. We have limitations on when you can register, how you can register. Texas is one of the few states that continues to not have online registration. We also have limitations as it relates to felons cannot have their voting rights maintained. They have to actually petition to have it come back. So there's a lot of sort of structural problems in place. And if you are an older person, you no longer drive, the chances are you for having a ID that comports with the voter ID law increases greatly. So we know that all of this is in place. The question then is how do you manage this process, both not just from a partisan perspective, just from a good government, the desire to want to have sort of more citizens involved in the process. Do you see the legislature looking at this now that we have some finality and maybe saying during the next session, let's create a statewide Texas voter ID program, let's make it easier to get a voter ID that works, or is it going to continue to be narrowed?
I suspect that you're going to see a narrowing. That has been the tradition in states that have implemented voter IDs. I don't know if there's a partisan motive one could ascribe to it in every case, but definitely in Texas, there's a sense that the outcome has been a partisan outcome. Trying to reduce the electorate, especially the new electorate, is something that is a benefit to incumbents. And if the incumbents in this case are mostly Republicans, then they're definitely in better shape. So I don't see any efforts to make voting easier. The Republicans want to say this is about protecting the ballot, that it's about limiting fraud. And there's evidence of fraud, but like you say, it's not very significant. It's not very consistent. So it is definitely a fight that we're going to see. I suspect that, like you say, we're going to see an expanded legal battle here, but I don't know that it's going to get to the full court because I suspect that this is going to be something that the Democrats aren't going to win on.
Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to tell you why this change with the Texas voter ID law is so important to you.
So, Jay, we ran down some of the legal and political questions about the latest hearing, latest finding on voter ID. What do we take from this, and why should people care?
The right to vote and the ability to vote is sort of embedded in our Constitution. It's the fundamental basis of democracy. If you can't access the ballot, everything else doesn't matter. And so anything that's going to limit that, I think, is really problematic. We know that this law will adversely affect certain communities. And for me, I think it's really important to have a process that's as open and transparent as possible. We ought to be encouraging more people to vote, not making it harder for them.
And I think that to that point, we need to be more, I think, clear about what the laws are. And most people have a relatively unclear sense of what their rights are and what their responsibilities are. We need to make that more clear. Parties need to make that more clear. And stronger parties in that way make that responsibility easier, make that job easier. So I think that the parties are going to have to live with this. And so they're going to have to find a way to educate voters and make it clear what their responsibilities are and what their rights are.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Thanks to our executive producer, Don Geraci, our web producer, Giselle Bueno and Matt Prendergast, and our graphics guru, Michelle Lamb. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Space Race Holslander. And before we go, we wanted to send out a big thank you to our outgoing executive producer, Edel Howland, who has been with us from the start. She's moving to Philadelphia, where hopefully she won't become an Eagles fan, but she'll always be with us in spirit, even if she's not here in the room with us.
Absolutely. She's the brainchild behind this entire podcast, and we are going to miss her terribly, but we will carry on, and the spirit of Edel Howland will be part of Party Politics.
Forever.
Forever. I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.